Yeah, okay. I'm going to talk about the dry bone theory and quantum field theory. So I'm going to try to give an overview of what has been established in this field. So in particular, I'm going to present various models for quantum field theory. And I will pay particular attention to the three models which have been involved in developing. So the first one is a Dirac-C model that is joint work with Samuel Colin at Perimeter Institute. The other two were joint work with Hans Westman, who's here at the conference. And so the outline of the talk is, well, at first I'm going to tell you briefly what the bright bone theory is. I'm going to give you some details of how non-relativistic the bright bone theory works. So most of you will be familiar with that. And then I'm going to leave the technical details aside when it comes to quantum field theory. I'm just going to sketch the ontologies of these various models and going to raise some, and I'm going to discuss conceptual issues. So I've listed the three models here for quantum field theory, which I was involved in developing. There's a fourth model, which is worth mentioning already, and that's a model by Dürr, Goldstein, Tomulka, and Zanghi. And that model, just as these three models, is capable of reproducing the standard quantum predictions. But I'll tell more about that later. So first of all, what is the Breuer-Bohm theory? Well, okay, let me first say that it goes under various names. So people also call it pilot wave theory, call it Bohmian mechanics, causal interpretations. That is all essentially the same theory. So in the Breuer-Bohm theory, how does it work? You typically have, in the Breuer-Bohm theory, systems are described by a wave function, which satisfies the Fourier equation, and also by some extra variables. And these extra variables I'm going to call beables. It's terminology introduced by John Bell. And these extra variables or beables, these can be particle positions or field configurations or something else. And their motion, so the motion of these beables, is influenced by psi, by the wave function. So the wave function kind of pushes around these beables, these positions, these particle positions or these field configurations. So most of you will be familiar with just non-relativistic De Broglie-Bohm theory, the theory originally presented by De Broglie and Bohm. And this theory, you just have the non-relativistic Schrödinger equation, and you have some velocity law for the particles. So you see the velocity of the particles is determined by the phase of the wave function, and also by the positions of the other particles. So first of all, I want to emphasize this point that according to the Breuer-Bohm theory, the image of the world is in the beables, in the positions or in the fields. It's not in the wave function. Okay. And one further point, so these beables, I already told you, these beables can be kind of anything, but there's at least one requirement that they have to satisfy. That's a requirement that John Bell pointed out. He said that the beables on some macroscopic levels should yield an image of the everyday macroscopic world. Okay? So because everything we see around us, that's all macroscopic stuff. We see tables, chairs, we see computer outprints when we do experiments. So even when we do an experiment on a microscopic system, the information of this microscopic system is revealed to us by some macroscopic device or some microscopic stuff. I will also come back to that later. So the De Broglie-Bohm theory also reproduces the standard quantum predictions, at least if the distribution of the beables is given by psi squared, and that's called the equilibrium distribution. Okay, you can also have, in principle, distributions different from psi squared. For such distributions, you will have different predictions than quantum theory. And Anthony Valentini is exploring this. So,
Why don't you include the psi in the image of the world? So you made a point that it's just the beables that are part of the image of the world. But what about psi itself? It's changing dynamically.
Yep. So psi is still in the theory, right? I'm not denying that, but when I want to know whether there's a table there or not, I'm going to look at the variables, right? Not psi. So for example, if I have a supposition of a string, if I consider Schrodinger's cat, the supposition of the cat being alive and being dead, I'm not going to read it off of the wave function, what it is. No, I'm going to just look at the particles. Do the particles configure such that they give the image of an alive cat? Then I'm going to say, okay, there's an alive cat in my world. Okay.
But is the wave function a property of the world or one? Is it a mathematical tool or is it?
I don't really care so much. At least it's determining dynamics of the variables. Sorry?
I probably don't care either, but maybe other people do, so. But you're not going to take a position.
No, so I'm just saying how I interpret my theory, right? I'm saying, look, what I know about the world, it's in the variables, right? And the wave function is pushing around these variables.
Pushing them around.
Pushing them around.
Sounds like it's in the world.
Well, whatever you want to call it. But for example, I'm not going to say, look, there's a cat there because my wave function has this form. No, that I'm not able to say. I'm going to say, look, positions have this form, so that's why there's a cat. Does that answer your question? Or?
That argument.
Sorry?
The whole point of the table is that a table holds things up. If all you have is some particles in position, they won't hold up that jug of water. The jug of water is going to fall straight through the table. The fact that it doesn't is a property of the interactions between the particles in the jug of water and the particles in the table, and that's driven by the dynamics, and you don't have that without the wave function.
Yes, sure.
So
I'm not saying...
The chromatic field, which is still classical and still another set of variables, and all this is a complete wave function.
Okay, but that's not part of
So I'm not saying that the wave function is not part of my theory, right? I'm saying it's part of my theory, but do you want to say is it part of my world? Is it real or not real? That doesn't help me.
It's sufficient for answering any question about the state of affairs in the world. It would be sufficient to consider just the particle.
Yeah. And you should only consider the particles according to me.
That's not true, though.
I think you just don't want to... You kind of just avoid this controversy by just saying it's sufficient to consider the particle.
I think we should avoid this controversy by saying that the standard interpretational assumption behind the Bohm theory is what Moore told us. And there are some subtle questions one can ask, but we'll leave them to later.
I think everybody can understand how the theory works, right? If I say it this way, look at the image of the world I get from my variables. Don't look at the wave function just as variables. So I guess everybody understands. But you want to call the wave function real or not real?
Or totally unrelated question.
Well, yeah. I opened a can of worms.
Totally.
Detracted them for 5 minutes.
Why do we call this an equilibrium distribution? Is there some intuition with thermal?
I'm going to say a little bit more about that, but not very much because that's outside the scope of this talk. So now, back to non-relativistic Debye-Bohm theory. So how can it be derived? So I'm going to show you how you can actually derive it. And when we come to these models of quantum field theory, I'm not going to repeat it how you derive it, but it's kind of a similar strategy you apply. So what do you do? You just look at the continuity equation for psi squared. And in standard quantum theory, you interpret psi squared as the probability density to find the particles at x at a certain time t. And in the Debye-Bohm theory, I'm just going to say, look, I have particles at all time, when I measure them, before I measure them, after I measure them. And the probability density for these particles is given by x, by psi squared. Okay? And then from the continuity equation, then it's natural to take v, this velocity, the field that appears in the continuity equation, as the velocity field of my particles. Okay? And that's completely analogy with fluid dynamics. So now we're going to expand a bit on Robin's question. So psi squared is regarded as the equilibrium distribution, right? You can also have different distributions from psi squared, right? Of course, we haven't seen this yet in laboratories or just around us. So but in principle, the theory does not forbid to have distributions different from psi squared. And there's different ways of trying to justify that we have psi squared distributions in our world. Right? I'm not going to say very much about it because that would be a completely different talk. I just want to mention, look at all these justifications. These are kind of inspired by justifications you have in classical statistical mechanics to argue for the uniform distribution or the Maxwell distribution. So when you get all the controversy that goes with all these justifications, you just take that with you here in the Brayer-Brunswick. So I just want to mention, I just want to report one result that is very important for some of these derivations. So it's important, for example, for the typicality approach of Drew, Goldstein, and Zanke, for people who know that. It's also important for Howard Wiseman's derivation, which is rooted in the Bayesian approach. So what is this? I'm going to explain this now. So first of all, psi squared, I said, look, this is an equilibrium distribution. But unlike in classical statistical mechanics, this distribution is not stationary. It changes in time, right? In classical statistical mechanics, you say, look, my equilibrium distribution should be stationary. It shouldn't change in time. Once I'm in equilibrium, I stay in equilibrium. There's a natural notion, or the generalization to the Brayer-Bohm theory of the stationarity is equivariance. So what is this? Let me first explain it to you by this special distribution of psi squared. So suppose my distribution of Beagles, so in this case it's particles, suppose my distribution of particles is equal to psi squared at a certain time. Right? And then suppose I evolve this distribution rho according to the Bohm flow, right, along the Bohm trajectories. Then I'm going to get a different distribution at a later time. Right? But then we know that distribution is just going to be equal to psi squared. That's basically because these two distributions, rho and psi squared, both satisfy the continuity equation. And they're equal at some initial time. So what is being expressed here is that if my distribution equals psi squared at a certain time, it will preserve that functional form as a function of psi over time, right? That's a covariance. And expressed more technically, functional rho, which depends on psi, is a covariant if this equality holds. Okay? And on the left-hand side, this distribution is the one that is obtained from rho of psi by just letting it evolve according to the Brayer-Bohm evolution. Okay. On the right-hand side, you have rho of psi t, which is obtained from rho of psi by just evolving psi according to the Schrodinger equation. Okay. So the identity of these two evolutions kind of that's trying to capture some notion of time independence, right? And maybe you don't see it immediately, but you can make that actually much more precise. But I won't do that here. So it's kind of capturing some kind of notion of time independence. And so Howard Wiseman is going to talk about that later. So Howard Wiseman sees this as kind of some generalized notion of the principle of indifference. So what is important here, what I want to mention here is that this rho of psi is not uniquely determined by just requiring a covariance, right? So some people were hoping for that, like Howard, also Drew, Goldstein, and Zanke were kind of hoping for that a covariance alone would give you uniquely psi squared, because then they could argue, look here, it's natural to assume that the world is going to be given by psi squared distribution because it's unique and some other motivations. So, but you get uniqueness if you just add one other natural looking assumption. So if you assume next to equivariance, if you also assume that your functional of psi is a local functional, by which I mean that it's that your functional of psi is just up to some normalization n, it's just a function of x, of psi at x, and of derivatives of psi at x. So this function does not depend on psi at values y, which are different from x. Okay. So if you add this condition, you get uniqueness. Right? So if you want to try to argue that the world is in equilibrium by some justification, and you assume that you have equivariance, that will be insufficient. So you also have to assume this natural-looking condition. Okay. Any questions so far? So I won't come back to that now. So I'll just continue with non-relativistic de Broglie-Bohm theory. So now I'm going to say how it reproduces the quantum predictions. So I already told you, look, you get this velocity field by just looking at the continuity equation for psi squared. But that alone is not sufficient to guarantee you a model which is going to give you the same predictions as quantum theory in equilibrium. You also need the following property. You need the property that wave functions representing microscopically distinct systems are approximately disjoint. Okay. So for example, suppose I have the wave function of a needle pointing up and a wave function of a needle pointing down. I want these wave functions to be approximately non-overlapping in the configuration space. Okay. Why do I want this? If this is true, right, my configurations can only reach distinct regions in configuration space. So typically here or here. And if the configurations are in this region, these configurations are going to represent the needle pointing up. If the configurations are in that region, they're going to represent a needle pointing down. Okay. And in particular, suppose I have a superposition of these two, right? Superposition of wave function of needle pointing up and a needle pointing down. My configuration is going to either be displaced on needle pointing up or they're going to displace on needle pointing down. So then so what I just said, you can also apply that to a Schrodinger's cat paradox, right? And then you can see, look, Schrodinger's cat will either be alive or dead because the configurations are either going to look like a cat which is alive or a cat which is dead. Okay? So if you have this separation of microscopically distinct packets, it guarantees that measurement results will be recorded in the configurations. But more generally, it will guarantee that you have an image of the classical world at the microscopic level. Is that clear? So in the following, I will just focus on this, that the Beables give you an image of the macroscopic world. I'm not just going to give you all this technical requirement anymore, that you need separation of packets. Okay. So in order to reproduce the quantum predictions, you need the equilibrium distribution, and you need that wave functions representing macroscopically distinct systems are approximately disjoint. This disjointness of these packets also gives you the emergence of the standard collapse rule. So how is that? So suppose I have a wave function which evolves into some superposition, and these two terms in the superposition are approximately non-overlapping. Well, so here I've sketched the support of this wave function. So here I have configuration space, time is going up, and the shaded area is just the support of the wave function. Then my particles or my Beables are either going to follow this one branch or they're going to follow this other branch. And for example, in this case, they follow this branch. And what this means is that this packet is not going to influence the motion of the particles anymore. So if these packets never re-interfere again, you can just forget about this one term of the wave function. And this is a collapse rule, an effective collapse. So that explains the success of the ordinary collapse from the standard quantum theory. Okay. So when I'm going to quantum field theory, I'm gonna sketch you. I'm gonna try to sketch you the ontology of these models. So I'm always gonna look at the Stern-Gerlach experiment, right? That contains all the features I want to discuss. So just to recall you what Stern-Gerlach experiment is. So here I have a source which emits particles that spin up in the x direction, for example, an electron. Here I have the Stern-Gerlach magnets, okay? Particles are either going up or down, right? It goes up. I have spin up in the z direction. Suppose this is the z direction. I have spin up in the z direction. If it goes down, I have spin down in the z direction. I also have a needle which is pointing like that before the experiment is completed, when it is spin up, the needle is going to point up. When it is spin down, the needle is going to point down. And I'm also considering some radiation scattering of the needle. So if an observer here is looking at it, he's going to look at it by making use of this radiation. So this light is coming from some lamp and it's scattering off the needle. So if the needle is like that, my wavy lines representing the radiation go like that. If my needle is pointing up, my wavy lines go up. And if the needle is pointing down, my wavy lines go down. Okay. So the standard quantum mechanical description goes as follows. So I have my state of spin up in the x direction. I have my needle pointing like that. And my particular form of radiation here, which I denote by these wavy lines, which are horizontal. Then Schrodinger evolution brings this state to this state, to the superposition of spin up in the z direction and spin down in the z direction. And then a collapse occurs, and that brings me to either one of these packets. And suppose, for example, it brings me to this packet. Then I'm going to say, look here, the result is spin up. Okay? So in non-relativistic de Broglie-Bohm theory, which I described just a minute ago, this is drawn like this. So here you have these magnets. Right, all these particles are making up the magnet. Here you have this electron. You can see it. So here is the electron, and it's moving up. So it's going to be the result of the measurement is going to be spin up. So this situation is very special because already the position of the system itself, the microscopic system itself, reveals the outcome. So then at a later time, really the measurement has occurred and my needle has flipped up. Okay? That's how I visualize it in the Broglie theory.
How is the static magnetic field that the Stern-Gerlach apparatus represented in the Bohm theory?
So here I left it out.
Okay.
Yeah. So I haven't introduced any Beagles for that, but of course
it's
in a more
obvious that there are
so yeah, later I'm going to talk about field models, and then there will be models where this magnetic field is represented.
But
in principle, you don't need to, right? Because so if you look back at Bell's requirement, the Beagle should give you an image of the microscopic world. So then clearly, just having these positions of the particles already give you this image of the microscopic world.
I only asked because you introduced the radiation field.
Okay. Yeah, that's for later purposes, when I'm going to introduce these. Okay, thanks. But you could, of course, add those. So now quantum field theory. So when you make the move from non-relativistic theory to quantum field theory, there's some issues that appear, right? So the first issue is, which ontology are we going to choose? So already on the standard quantum mechanical level, there is discussions. Should we see quantum field theory as a theory about fields, or should we see it as particles? So on the one hand, you have obtained the theory by quantizing the classical field theory, so you obtain field operators. But on the other hand, you realize these field operators in some Fock representation, and that makes the particle ontology more manifest. So we will see that in these De Broglie-Bohm models, you can actually go both ways. You could choose particles as Biables, or you could choose fields as Biables. So you have some kind of underdetermination here. So a more important problem when you try to do De Broglie-Bohm models for quantum field theory is that the standard quantum field theory is basically about the scattering matrix. And the scattering matrix gives you transition amplitudes from some asymptotic-free initial state to some asymptotic-free final states, right? Usually you don't have some Schrodinger evolution for some wave function, okay? So now, because in non-volatile physics, De Broglie-Bohm theory, you needed kind of this Schrodinger evolution because the wave function was telling you how the particles had to move, right? Was telling the particles how to move. So now, if you don't have this Schrodinger evolution in standard quantum field theory, so how are we going to define the motion of our Biables for quantum field theory? And this is not only a problem for the Broglie-Bohm theory, it's actually a problem for any kind of interpretation for quantum field theory which takes the wave function seriously. So, of course, there's people trying to develop Schrodinger type of evolutions for quantum field theory, right? But so far, they only have had limited success. And one of the problems you might know that you encounter when you try to do that is Haag's theorem. So you have to get past Haag's theorem. So in all these models, what is done there is just, it is assumed that there is an ultraviolet cutoff. Right? We just put it there. And we also assumed a bounded space. So this makes the effective number of degrees of freedom finite. So because the effective number of degrees of freedom is finite, you again have a well-defined Schrodinger evolution, and your evolution of your Biables is well-defined.
Yeah. Which is not estimating the calculation. Presumably, you would say that this also introduces an effective ultraviolet cutoff.
Yeah, exactly. So that would be the same. So also, it's not always done explicitly. So you could actually also choose a lattice approach. You could say I assume a lattice, find my fields on the lattice, and assume a finite lattice. So for some models, this is not done explicitly because it just would clutter things up. So whenever I'm saying, look here, these models reproduce the predictions of quantum field theory, you should actually then always understand it as follows, that these models actually reproduce some regularized version of quantum field theory. Okay? And if you were, so nobody has done it yet, but if you were going to try to remove this cutoff by just taking the limit to infinity, the Schrodinger evolution would become ill-defined, right? But it might be that the Biable evolution could still be well-defined. Or at least it could be that if you take a limit that you can ensure by modifying the law of motion for the Biable, that this law of motion is still well-defined if you take the limit. Okay? So and this is kind of an interesting idea to pursue, because look here, in the Broglie-Bohm theory, what is fundamental is the Biables, right? It's not the wave function. If the wave function is not well-defined in some limit, it doesn't really matter, as long as the Biables are still well-defined, and as long as their motion is still well-defined. Okay? So this might be a way to go beyond quantum field theory. So let me now go to the actual models. So first of all, let me look at particle ontology. So the first to introduce some kind of particle ontology for quantum field theory, or more specifically for fermionic quantum field theory, was John Bell, and he assumed the lattice, and he assumed that the Beagles were the number of fermions at lattice points. So at each lattice point you had a number of fermions, and these fermions were hopping around on the lattice. Okay? And then Dirk Olsen and Zangi took up this model and tried to make a continuum generalization of it. And you have some kind of continuum generalization where the particles move along some trajectories in a continuous fashion, and then when there is pair creation, or when then there's particle creation or annihilation, then suddenly particles appear or disappear. Okay? And there's also Coulin took up this model of Bell and constructed a different continuum generalization. And he did it by making the picture of the Dirac scene manifest. Okay? And he obtained a deterministic model. So it's a bit surprising that you have two different models which seem to be continuum generalizations of Bell's work. But these just arise from a different reading of what Bell wrote. So Bell was so compact in his writing that it was open to ambiguity. So Collin did it for electromagnetic interactions, and we recently looked at how to extend that to other types of interactions, like weak interactions. And this, again, with using the Dirac picture. So Dugold and Zangi's and Tomuka's picture is like how most people in quantum field theory think, right? You have particles moving around and suddenly you can have particles appearing or disappearing. So this is complete, the Dirac scene is completely different. So, but in effect, what these theories do is just replacing Bell's lattice spacing as a regulator by just replacing by some cutoff, energy cutoff, right? So they just make shift from one regulator to another regulator. Okay. So let me first go to this Dirac scene model. Okay. So let me just recall first what the Dirac scene picture is in standard quantum field theory. So for example, let me just look at pair creation. In a standard representation in quantum field theory, what does pair creation look like? It looks as follows. So negative energy states cannot be occupied by particles, only positive energy states can be occupied. So these circles are just the holes where you can possibly have a particle. And pair creation is just that you have creation suddenly of a particle and of an antiparticle. Okay. In the Dirac scene representation, negative energy states are occupied, right? If I have a positive energy particle, it cannot fall down by the Fermi exclusion principle. And if you have pair creation, that's just one of these negative energy particles, which acquires positive energy, and leaving behind this hole, which is then the antiparticle. So the main reason why, if you make this Dirac scene interpretation explicit in the Bright-Bohm theory, the main reason why you end up with a deterministic model is because you actually have conservation of particle number. Okay, the actual number of particles is conserved, although there are actually an infinite number of particles in your scene if you don't deduce cutoff and a bounds case. So in this Dirac scene model, what other people just positions, and you can introduce positions for all the particles, also the negative energy particles. Okay, here are just some equations, which are not really important. Let me go to the Stern-Gerlach experiment again. So this is what the experiment looks like in this ontology. So you just have this background of vacuum particles, right? And somewhere here, there's this electron moving around. And when the measurement is performed, suddenly the needle pops up, and that means, okay, we have found the results spin up. So here you already see that, look here, you don't see the, you don't know exactly where the microscopic system is. The microscopic system doesn't reveal you the outcome of the measurement, but again, this microscopic needle reveals what the outcome of the measurement is. So we still have an image of the microscopic world. So one thing that is important here is that you have a cutoff. So in this model, we had to introduce a cutoff, because if you would let the cutoff grow, what would happen is that this background would become more dense. And in the limit, the cutoff to infinity, you would just have, over the whole space, you would have approximately two particles at each point in space. So in that scenario, you wouldn't be able to read off anything, right? Because in each region you would look, you would just find an infinite number of particles. Okay, so here it's important that you introduce a cutoff such that this background of vacuum particles is not too dense. And what we don't want either is that this background fluctuates too much, because otherwise, if it would fluctuate too much, it could suddenly appear macroscopic objects or something, or it could be mistaken for some macroscopic object just from the vacuum.
Just following up on
the
earlier question that you got to it,
Yeah. And also around the needles, you change this background.
These correspond to what you think of as virtual particles.
Yeah. So the way they are arranged, that tells you where the virtual particles is. If they were just uniformly, then there would be no virtual particles. But of course, they're...
So an empty vacuum has no virtual particles?
Yes, it has, but in the Dirac-C picture, this is represented in a different way, right?
Sorry. Yeah.
So if I just have the vacuum, yeah. So in the Dirac-C picture, if I would just have the free vacuum, right, so no virtual particles, right, I would still have this background of particles.
Okay.
Does that make it clear? So you don't want these particles to fluctuate too much, okay?
Can I ask a question? I mean, you're drawing this, you said you don't want the density too high, but surely to agree with quantum field theory, your cutoff has to be very small in space. The density is going to be enormously more dense than ordinary matter. So the picture is not going to be like this. It's going to be an enormously dense, uniform background, on top of which there's a little bit of extra density
So we did an actual calculation. So it was a bit naive because we excluded all kinds of interactions. So we just took the free vacuum and then the state representing some macroscopic matter, right, at some region. And we just looked at and we also assumed the cutoff at the Planck energy. And then we looked at how big the region should be so that we can distinguish macroscopic matter from just vacuum. Okay? And we found that if you look in regions with a diameter which is bigger than 10 to the minus 6 meter, you can really distinguish this vacuum.
So distinguishing in what sort of sense are you talking?
By just looking at the number of particles in this region.
Are you assuming for some fluctuation?
Yeah, so we looked at the expected number of particles in the region for the vacuum state and for the state with macroscopic matter in this region, and then just calculated the standard deviation.
Assuming Poissonian statistics?
No.
Well, how can you calculate the standard deviation without some assumption on the statistics?
Well, you know what the operator is, right? You have an operator which gives you the number of particles in a region. No. Because it's the Dirac-C now, right? So it's the number of...
Isn't the vacuum in the Dirac-C that you have, every level, every negative energy level is
Yeah.
Exactly for every positive is exactly empathy. So isn't that an eigenstate?
Of the total particle number.
So it's
not an eigenstate of the particle number density, but it's of course an eigenstate of the total particle number.
Okay, yeah. I see.
Sorry.
So this is where so that's nice. There's no difficulty there in distinguishing. But nevertheless, it is still the case, isn't it, that your picture here is sort of misleading because the actual density of states in the Dirac C is enormous.
Also, that of microscopic matter is enormous.
Well, that would be much more. The density of particles in the Dirac C would for sure be much more.
So we did this calculation. It was kind of naive because we didn't exclude any interactions, but still there was a damping of the fluctuations, and the damping of the fluctuations actually came from the Pauli exclusion principle, because that was still present in the calculation. So you also can imagine now, if you would include electromagnetic interaction, that you will have extra repulsion of the particles in your background, so that would even damp the fluctuations more. Okay, you would get a better result, according to me, if you would include at least the electromagnetic interactions. If you would include the extra weak interactions, I'm not sure what would exactly happen then. So now just another comment on this picture. So if you would look at Durgos and Zanghi's picture, how they would sketch this theory, this model, you would actually have exactly the same picture. Because as Steve was saying, then these particles are just the virtual particles which are there. Okay, there's just one distinguishment between the models. So in the Dirac C models, all particles are identical. So these are all identical particles. There's no way to distinguish an electron from a positron or from a quark, except for in the behavior. In the model of Durgos and Zanghi, that is different. So you have different particles. Not all particles are identical. So the difference between the two models would be that, look, in the Dirac C model, I've colored every particle black. In their model, you could give the different particles a different color. So. So now the field ontology. So the field ontology you can do for bosonic fields. So when Bohm already did that in his seminal paper in 1952, he looked at electromagnetism. And he introduced a Biable B, and that's just some kind of magnetic field. Right? Plays the same role as the classical magnetic field and classical Maxwell's theory. Okay? So if you want to do similar things, if you want to do a field ontology for fermionic fields, then it's not so simple. So Holland constructed some nice model. It's very nice equations. His actual Biable is some field psi, some field in space, and it's constructed from some angle valued fields and momentum space. So this construction is a bit complicated. So, and because this construction is a bit complicated, it's kind of hard to tell whether this model is a good model or not. So, and there are some indications to believe that it isn't really going to reproduce the quantum predictions. Essentially, because it isn't going to give you an image of the macroscopic world. But I don't know for sure. So there was another approach by Valentini. So Valentini, he thought, look here, in standard quantum field theory, if you take a path integral for fermionic fields, use these anti-commuting fields. So maybe you can introduce an ontology in terms of these anti-commuting fields. This approach doesn't really work. So, although you can introduce dynamics for anti-commuting fields, it's not clear how you should introduce dynamics in order to have something like an equilibrium distribution that is preserved. Okay, so that approach fails so far. So, And then there's this minimalist model, which was developed together with the Hands. What we just looked at is, for example, quantum electrodynamics, and we considered our wave function, which contains the electromagnetic degrees of freedom represented by this magnetic field, and also some fermionic degrees of freedom represented by F, which labels fermionic Hilbert space. And our Beeble, we just took the same Beeble as in Bohm's theory for the free electromagnetic field. We just introduced this magnetic field. Okay. So no Beebles at all for fermionic degrees of freedom. So that's why it's called minimalist model. So this is also a deterministic model. So this is how the Stern-Gerlach experiment looks like. Although it's actually a little bit exaggerated, right? Because I've just drawn the radiation scattering of the needle, right? There's of course background radiation, there's thermal radiation from the needle. There's also the magnetic field, as Steve pointed out, from these magnets. But so what's important here is our measurement results, right? These are here encoded in this radiation scattering of the needle. From that, we can read off what the outcome was. So actually, surprisingly, there's a lot of information in the electromagnetic field, right? Because if you would imagine here in this room and you would analyze, like, suppose you take classical electrodynamics and you would analyze the radiation just in this region here in space, you would be able to form an image of this whole room, right? You would be able to tell where the people are positioned in their chairs and stuff like that. So there's a lot of information in the electromagnetic field, right? And that's why this model can work. So, and you should also not be mistaken that there's that the fermions are completely thrown away, right? The fermionic degrees of freedom are still in the wave function, right? And the wave function is still telling you how this electromagnetic field should behave. Okay?
Or,
yeah?
Am I correct that you're only getting half of the electromagnetic field that you'd be able to set up?
Exactly.
The
yeah.
B components, something like that.
Yeah, so here I only introduced B components. But in principle, you could also add E components.
Well, I'm just thinking about the analogy that the non-relativistic theory, we have positions and we don't really have momentum.
Yeah.
So that's the same sort of relation.
Yeah,
so it's a little bit contentious to say that you have all that information, that classical information.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that fair though? Yeah, that's completely correct. Yeah, so it's extra minimalist. No, but you could add this E field. That's actually what's coming next. So this minimalist model itself works, right? With limit works. And now once you have this minimalist model, you can actually introduce extra variables for almost kind of whatever you want. So for example, what you could do is now introduce variables for fermions. And how are you going to do that? You're going to look at the fermion. For example, you're going to introduce a charge distribution as a variable. What you're going to do is look at the charge density operator in this fermionic Hilbert space. And you're going to switch it between the actual wave functional, right? And this whole expression you're going to evaluate for the actual value of your magnetic field. So the actual variable B for the magnetic field. For any kind of, for a lot of operators, you can do this kind of construction and you can get to some kind of meaningful variable representing fermionic degrees of freedom or some extra bosonic degrees of freedom.
So you're not actually adding anything in a way, you're just creating functions of your magnetic field and saying, I might as well regard these as real. Is that
but you have to actually postulate it, right? You actually have to postulate the nuclear. This is also an element of my theory, this is a variable. From that, I can also read off
separate dynamics or anything like that.
But the dynamics is completely determined by this equation.
B has its separate dynamics, but this is all just determined by B and your wave function.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it's just, I mean,
You don't need to write down an equation of motion for that, because no. the time evolution is completely determined by the wave function and by the evolution of
the wave. So you could adopt the point of view that, you know, in one way of looking at it, that if all these extras come, you know, I just a different way of looking at them in this problem.
I don't think that do.
No.
So I think you really have to postulate it. Because in the end, your image, you read it off from the variables, right? And you really have to specify what your variables are. So I'm just going to finish up. So in this ontology, this is how the Stern-Gerlach measurement looks like. So all what is black is actually densities, but it's kind of plotted in 2D. So here the electron, you see I have two contributions to my charge density. So there's a packet going either way. And it's only when it finally hits the screen, my electron, and it interacts with this radiation, and this radiation records the outcome, that actually my charge density will collapse to some charge density which is located here up. Okay, so it has kind of a flavor of a collapse model to it. So now just a conclusion. So there are several Debye-Bohm theories possible, right? Deterministic, stochastic, you can introduce particles or fields. What could be done next, or what should be done next, is just look, can you really remove these regulators, this cutoff, and by preserving the dynamics of these variables, can this be done? And then another thing is this study of non-equilibrium. Valentini is pursuing this kind of research, and he's indicating that, look, if you want to find non-equilibrium distributions, you will have to look in extreme situations where you have strong gravitational fields, or in cosmological situations where you have inflation. So, and all these situations require field theoretical description. So if you want to make a prediction for non-equilibrium, right, then you should consider kind of all these models and see maybe some predictions are model dependent, maybe not. So in the end, it's better that some non-equilibrium predictions are not model dependent, because otherwise you kind of lose your predictive power. Okay, I'll stop here.
We have 2 minutes for questions. I think Steve was the first one up, but he's asked a lot of questions. Maybe this other guy.
I'm having trouble with the analogy between the variables of X and the non-relevance component and the magnetic field and the relevance component. And you said in the non-relevance side, when you don't come to port, when the X's converge, that basically breaks it. But if you're doing like an atomic spectroscopy experiment, where the information is in an outgoing photon, you want to know what the frequency is, you have one possible frequency of the magnetic field and another one on top of it. Where do you lose the common support?
You have one photon, so you will have common support. A lot of common support.
So why do I see one frequency and not two?
Well, because you include some measurement device to actually measure the frequency of your photon. So from microscopic systems, sometimes you cannot really tell what it is representing. It is one frequency or the other frequency. But as soon as you couple it to some macroscopic system, some detector.
What if I'm looking at the color of the photon?
Well, then the electrons or particles in your brain. So, but of course, in the end, you would have to go so far as accounting for your experience in terms of your brain. But you can actually kind of stop at the macroscopic level. So if I can give an account of the macroscopic world, that's already satisfactory enough. You see what I mean? There's no need to actually explain all your experiences of this world as it is.
So presumably in this, presumably in this, the latter model with the magnetic field of the vehicle, there's also going to be some scale on which you have to, because you have backing fluctuations in the magnetic field as well. So there's going to be some scale before you're able to see, you know, like real information that you were talking about coming from showing the condition of macroscopic objects. See that above the background of the vacuum fluctuations. Have you looked at that in this model?
Here there is actually not so much need to look at that in detail, because you will find it in the classical radiation. So here we can argue, like, look here, since we see definite states of classical radiation.
Well, not in the sense that we don't usually make, you know, projective measurements of a magnetic field in order to do our observations. Typically, no. We absorb photons, and you don't see magnetic fluctuations when you absorb photons. So I don't think the answer is that simple.
But you can say here in this case, look, if quantum field theory is correct, right? If my needle is pointing like that, the state of radiation should be representing some kind of classical state of radiation. All right?
Yeah,
and then
that's
and instructional.
There should also be some scale on, you know, before you're able to say a statement like that. So it'd be interesting to know what that was.
Yeah. So, but here you kind of believe that there's the macroscopic scale.
Like,
for example, with the Dirac-C model, it's very different because that ontology is really different from our experience. So, and also in classical standard quantum field theory,
I don't know if most physicists believe that the vacuum fluctuations are real. I don't know that it's necessarily such a different. There's such a difference between the two models.
Okay, I think Owen is now ready. Let's thank Ward again for nice talk. And the next speaker is Owen Maroney from Perimeter Institute, whose power is off. Take it away. Okay, so the speaker is Owen Maroney speaking on Maxwell through the Looking Glass.
Okay, this slide is actually the title slide from a talk I gave a few months ago, but it was a panel discussion, so it was a 6 minutes presentation. But I thought that the title was just so good that it deserved better than a 6 minute presentation, so I decided to take the bones that were in that 6 minutes and expand it. It turned out when I got the bones together and put them together, it was a skeleton for a very, very large creature. So I had to put a lot of flesh on the bones. So when I'm running out of time at the end, remember, I actually did manage to do this in 6 minutes once. So, just one question. Could people just help put up their hands if you know about the Szilard engine. Okay, and also, could you put up your hand if you know about Landau erasure? Okay, that's quite good. Well, that should help. So, the talk is going to be looking at, I'm going to briefly go to run through the Szilard engine Landau's principle, which are two particular situations in Foundations of Statistical Mechanics that's a variation on Maxwell's demon and its supposed exorcism. And this has been subject to a number of criticisms in recent years, including by me. And I'm going to try and... That's to introduce it. Then I'm going to actually say, well, step back and say, what exactly was it one was trying to do by looking at things like the Szilard engine in the first place? And that's do what is actually very rarely been done in this particular thing, and actually go back to first principles of statistical mechanics and say, what actually was the object of the exercise in the first place? And it'll turn out that the actual problem that things have turned on is often an issue of macroscopic indeterminism. It's often been thought that statistical mechanics is about microscopic degrees of freedom. But much of the debate is actually over how one should understand macroscopic indeterminism and its relationship to entropy and thermodynamic entropy. And then, having done that, I'm going to claim I'm going to solve all of these problems very quickly, in one go. Can a Maxwell's demon exist? What's the validity of Landau's principle? Does understanding the Szilard engine require understanding information theory? And what's the statistical mechanical generalization of entropy? And all of it, in one go. Okay, I'm going to need four assumptions to do this, which I will tell you later. Although, I would say those assumptions are sufficient to solve all these problems, but they're not necessary. So one could actually conceive of weakening or changing those assumptions and still be able to attempt a resolution of these problems. These four assumptions may not be true. They have all been questioned, and I will mention that as well. So, Maxwell's demon, Szilard's engine, and Landau's principle. Maxwell's demon comes from this idea that the fluctuation phenomena are a challenge to the second law of thermodynamics. It goes back to this idea Maxwell had of a little light-fingered being that could actually separate a gas into faster and slower moving atoms and thereby set up a temperature difference or a pressure difference, and you can connect that up to some kind of valve or some kind of system which will extract energy from that in a perpetual motion machine. And it's generally been supposed that, well, Maxwell originally suggested that the problem is that it just had to be too small. In order to get hold of these atomic fluctuations, the demon just had to be too small, and we're just too big and we can't do it, and that's the reason why it's not possible. And of course the problem is that, well, the problem with that was that in 1905 a really clever chap by the name of Einstein showed that we actually could see those fluctuations. And as a result, it was suggesting that, well, if we actually can see the effects of those fluctuations, then it's not obvious that we can't get hold of those fluctuations and do something with them. So Smoluchowski and many following tried to then analyze if there were ways of actually getting hold of those fluctuations, and generally came to the conclusion that a sort of a mechanical demon that was to try and do this wouldn't really work, because the mechanical demon itself was constructed out of components that would have to be at the same temperature as the environment, and the microscopic motion of that mechanical demon would prevent it operating.
So Maxwell basically didn't believe that atoms were necessarily of a finite size. Is that essentially the...
It's really unclear what Maxwell actually believed, because, I mean, he discussed this demon in a couple of letters to Tate, and he didn't call it a demon, and it was Thomson that called it a demon, and Maxwell objected to the characterization as a demon.
That's what you're getting out of Einstein, and I mean, it's just the fact that the finiteness of atomic...
Well, the finiteness led to the result that we actually could observe those fluctuations. It's the observability of them, the fact that they actually became available to our actual senses, that it became conceivable that we could actually get hold of them. There's not really anything about a specific size of the atom that makes it viable or not. It was just that suddenly people realised if you could see them, maybe you could get hold of them. It wasn't a very good argument before that, I have to say. But the problem with this is that it's generally the Smoluchowski, the famous trapdoor, or Feynman in the Feynman lectures where he talks about a ratchet and pull, is all just dealing with things on a case-by-case basis. Someone goes, well, couldn't you do this? And then they sit down and work it out, and they say, no, you couldn't. And we're sort of supposed to infer from this that there's some general principle. But it's very rarely cleared from each case-by-case basis what the general principle is that's meant to rule out all such demons. And on the result of that, it always leaves open the possibility, well, okay, you tried to do this and this failed, but you know, where's the guarantee that you couldn't find something else to do? And that's a result that continues to be attempts and literature, and in some cases even conferences being held, exploring the question of, you know, maybe there's some other way we can do it. It would be really nice to actually have a general proof that could just stop all this. And I think there is. So, the Szilard engine is described basically as an atom. It's in a box, and I'm going to produce pictures, but I'm going to give a quick summary of this. It's an atom in a box. It's in thermal contact with a heat bath, and you can slide a partition into the box, and it traps the atom on one side or the other. And the idea is, by doing this, you've reduced the volume available to the atom. And now the atom is just an N-atom gas, where N is equal to 1. So you can actually calculate that, and you can say that its entropy has gone down. So we've actually sort of guaranteed the fluctuation. We've got a situation in which we can ensure that a fluctuation is going to happen. We're not, you know, waiting around with some spring or some kind of ratchet situation, waiting for fluctuations to happen. But the general description of the problem with this is you have to know which side of the partition the atom is on in order to actually be able to extract work from this reduction in entropy. And at first it was suggested, well, okay, you've got to perform a measurement and there's some information gathering, and maybe that's the situation where things go wrong. And this was Szilard's original idea, and this wasn't really worked out very well, although Brillouin and Gabor did do some work on this and tried to claim general principle. And von Neumann tried to claim a general principle on this, based on this. But a guy called Landauer actually showed that measurement couldn't be the answer. But there was then a follow-on. And it took until about the 1970s before Bennett took further work from Landauer and said that, well, what you've actually got to do is the demon has some information that was gathered, and that information needs to be erased for you to return to the original state, and that completes your cycle. And this has been subject to some criticism in recent years on a number of grounds. So there's been work by Ehrman and Norton and John Norton in papers which basically say, well, Landau's principle itself, actually its own validity is based upon assumptions of that the second law is valid. And as a result, the idea that you can't violate the second law because of a principle which is only true if the second law is true is some kind of circular reasoning. There's certainly a sort of consistency here, but it doesn't prove that you can't... If a Maxwell's demon did exist, then Landau's principle would be false. So there's not really actually a principle there. There's work by Schenker and Hemmo, and it's actually criticising some of the basis of Landau's principle, and says that, well, Landau's principle in itself, if you examine this carefully, it's not sustainable. It makes certain assumptions, and in fact, it has an illicit characterisation of entropy. And this at least leaves open the possibility of Maxwell's demon. And going even further than this, in a criticism in his book Time and Chance, David Albert actually quite explicitly, he doesn't say Landau's principle is irrelevant, he doesn't even mention it. He actually simply states Maxwell's demons are possible, and he's straight up front about it. Well, I'm going to say these people are all wrong. Well, this actually, there's merit in this, and these guys are wrong. And so I'm going to look into that in more detail. So we have a demon, quite a simple chap. He has a memory, and we're going to represent the memory by a box. It's got an atom in it. There's a division in the centre of the box, and it's a very simple memory. He can remember one thing at a time, a yes or no. If it's a left, it's yes, and if it's right, it's no. And the Szilard box, and it's a box, and it's got an atom in it, and it has a partition, and the partition can be moved inside. And notice that the memory and the box look extraordinarily similar, which is going to turn out to be quite significant. So it starts off with this atom in the box and the partition, and The daemon is here with his memory just in some particular state. And first of all, the daemon inserts the partition here in red into the box, which means that the atom ends up on one side or the other. And the daemon's there, still not knowing which side the atom is on. But the daemon knows that the atom's on one side or the other, and now he's going to actually try and extract some work from this. And the way he does that is he measures it so that if the atom is on the left side, the daemon thinks, OK, it's on the left side. And if the atom is on the right side, the daemon now thinks, aha, it's on the right side. So the daemon's memory is changed because he's performed a measurement. And then, making use of that information the daemon now has, if it's on the left side, if he knows it's on the left side, he moves the partition to the right-hand side. Slowly, and remember, isothermally, because the atom is in contact with the heat bath at all times. And if the similarly, if the atom is on the right-hand side, the daemon knows this, and he moves the partition to the left. And this is, in both cases, it's an isothermal expansion of an n-atom gas when n is equal to 1. And we know this calculation from undergraduate textbooks, and it tells us we can get at least nkt log 2, where n is equal to 1. So here I've got the amount of heat dissipated in the heat bath is greater than or equal to a negative number. What that actually means is you can get work out. If the amount of heat dissipated was greater than or equal to a positive number, it would mean you would have to put work in. And then at the end of the day, what the daemon just does is then removes this from the end, either end, and restores it to the centre, and now our box has returned to its initial situation. But the daemon actually still knows what it did, so it has some memory. And what this says is work can be extracted, which in itself troubles a lot of people. There's something rather bothersome about that. We've extracted heat, turned it into work from what looked like thermal fluctuations. So we need to actually account for how do we actually understand that? How do we describe that? Has it been the case that his entropy is a lack of information, that performing the measurement reduced the entropy? This would be one way of describing it. But there's also notice the daemon retains information at the end. It can remember what it did. Is this somehow, this daemon having the information at the end, compensating? Is that the sort of key to understanding why this isn't a violation of the second law? Or maybe this is a violation of the second law and we should just accept it, like Albert says. Each distinct state of the daemon has the same entropy. So the daemon remembering on the left-hand side and has the same entropy as the daemon remembering on the right-hand side, and both of those are the same entropy that the daemon had at the start. So you could argue, well, the daemon state hasn't changed. Its entropy, at least, hasn't changed. And this would be certainly Albert's argument, although there are other arguments that it isn't. But you've got to say, does the daemon possessing information change its entropy? And also, well, did we actually need to have the daemon there in the first place? Why did we actually need to have a correlation? And these are some of the questions that have been asked. The standard way of resolving this that was put forward by Bennett, earlier also by Oliver Penrose, and now tends to be referred to as the Landauer-Penrose-Bennett resolution, is that in order to really demonstrate something troubling has gone on, we need to complete the cycle and get back to here. And the way we do this is we have to obviously lose the information. And here's the process by which we do it. We draw the partition out of the daemon's memory, and we're going to put that in a box. And this is a process called Landau's erasure, where what we then do is we put the partition in one side and we slide it to the middle. But this is going to be a compression of the state of the daemon, which is the compression of a n-atom gas where n equals 1. So we know the actual amount that is, and that requires the generation of an amount of heat equal to at least kT log 2. And this add up, and the whole circuit, we actually have the total heat generated in the heat bath is greater than or equal to zero, and that means that we haven't violated the second law after all. Now, the criticism of this is, where's the principle? What is actually the principle behind Landauer erasure? And this is one of the... Why should one believe it? This is the criticism that Ehrman and Norton particularly push. It's circular. What's the independent grounds for believing there's no better way of getting from the extracted heat and the daemon having a memory to the original point on the cycle? I mean, we've just exhibited there's a path which requires you to dissipate at least kT log 2 heat. But what we actually need is a principle that says there's no way of doing better than that. And just simply showing one path doesn't prove there's no better way of doing that. And of course, if Landau's principle is just taken as being a statement that there is no better way of doing that, you know, where's the beef? How do you actually, why should you believe in that statement? Clearly, if it is true, then Maxwell's demons don't exist. But, in this case, but, you know, aren't you just stating Maxwell's demons don't exist in another form by saying you can't do better? What exactly is Landau's principle? Well, here's a number of statements of it. In erasing one bit of information, one dissipates on average at least k, that should be k small b, t log 2 of energy into the environment. One is that it's something about logically irreversible operations must be implemented by physically irreversible devices. And then there's a longer and quite careful statement by Bennett in 2003 saying that they have to have an entropy increase in the non-information varying degrees of freedom of the information processing apparatus or its environment. And conversely, logically reversible transformations of information can be accomplished by thermodynamically reversible. So here there's something about logically irreversible operations. Here it's something about erasing bits. Here's logically irreversible. Here's dissipating heat and physically irreversible. It doesn't explicitly state here that the logically irreversible has to be thermodynamically irreversible, but the conversely in this bit seems to imply that logically irreversible must be thermodynamically irreversible. Yes?
Since you brought us the part of this, when Bennett writes this, is there any significant distinction between non-information varying degrees of freedom of the apparatus and the environment, and then also sort of the environment?
It's left... He doesn't make explicit what he means in the paper. What it almost certainly does mean is that you can actually... We've assumed that, say, the demon's memory on the left-hand side is, and the right-hand side have the same entropy. What you could have is a situation where different logical states are represented by physical states that have different entropies. So the demon's memory could actually increase in volume. And in that case, what you could do is you could avoid dissipating heat in the environment by having the demon increase in size. So it would still be heat, but it would be heat inside the demon instead of heat pushed out into the world. And one of the criticisms, this is the Schenker and Hemo and Albert criticism, is, well, you know, why restore the demon? Why do I care about the demon's memory? Entropy's gone down, work's been extracted. Hurrah. Why? I mean, isn't this good? Isn't this a great thing? I mean, it would be fantastic. And when you actually think, well, what's the demon's state of the demon's memory? I mean, one way you can characterize this is the state of the demon's memory could be, suppose I had a shoe, and the shoe starts off at one place here on the table. And then at the end of the thing, if the demon saw it on the left-hand side, the shoe is here. And if the demon saw it on the right-hand side, the shoe is here. At the same time, I've got work out. Should I really care about where the shoe is sitting on the table? Shouldn't I just be, that's great, I've got work out, and a shoe happens to have moved around in where it's sitting on a table? And this is a way of characterizing Albert's argument. Well, I'm not going to answer those questions for now, because I think one can just get into an awful lot of trouble just by worrying about those kind of questions, instead of going back to first principles and saying, well, first of all, let's ask what statistical mechanics says, and then ask what statistical mechanics says about that. And I said, there would be four assumptions. One is I'm going to assume that we're dealing with unitary evolution on density matrices. So the state of the system is represented by a density matrix. There's obvious subtleties to that. There's negligible variation in interaction energies between system and environment, or between systems. And I'm going to make these more precise. Initial systems are statistically independent. There are no microscopic correlations. And no equivalent final condition. And this is, of course, going to be a very time-based symmetric assumption. And thermal state systems are Gibbs canonical states, which is certainly something that a lot of people would say you can't take for granted. Now, these are more or less standard textbook assumptions that you can find whether in Gibbs in 1902 or Tolman in 1938 or in textbooks ever since. This is a questionable one. But it turns out, and actually some interesting work that isn't perhaps widely known, is that this can actually be deduced from the statistical independence argument with some additional requirements. And there are various conditions here. But they more or less... it's an idea that actually was first noted by Gibbs in 1902. It was fleshed out by Szilard, and then very much more complicated versions of them were developed in the 70s and 80s. And one of the ideas it would be that if you have two systems at the same temperature as each other, then when viewed as a combined system, they are still at the same temperature. And that in itself, combined with statistical independence, is actually enough to uniquely select out the Gibbs canonical distribution, which is quite remarkable. Independent of any, no assumptions of ergodicity of any, or mixing or any other kind of thing. Now, all of these assumptions can be questioned, and these are some of the ways which they have been questioned. So, for example, wave function collapses into unitary evolution. On the other hand, that one isn't really going to be a challenge for thermodynamics because that's not going to decrease entropy in any kind of way we would normally understand that. There's an interesting model by Zhang and Zhang in which they have a non-unitary evolution. Well, it's non-Hamiltonian evolution because they deal with a classical system. But you can concoct non-unitary evolutions which are definitely going to lead to perpetual motion machines. And there's been some interesting claims by Alverdan and Nieuwenhuizen that this assumption not only is an assumption, but actually in certain circumstances must be false. And therefore, that this, in fact, can actually lead to perpetual motion, they claim. Statistical independence obviously has this tremendous time asymmetry built into it, in this asymmetry between the initial and the final condition. So it's the kind of thing that one worries about when we're worrying about arrow of time. So we certainly shouldn't be so careless about it as just to say, well, that's, you know, naturally rather obvious. We should actually be very careful about whether or not we can assume that. And it's the kind of thing that non-Markovian master equations don't assume. And it also turns out that non-extensive entropies cannot assume that consistently. Because non-extensive entropies lead to thermal systems that are not Gibbs canonical. But that can still be consistent, non-extensive entropies such as Tsalis entropy or the microcanonical entropy. But it turns out that you can only really consistently get those to work out if you don't assume statistical independence. But you can have other assumptions that you replace that are equally time asymmetric. Yes?
Are you going to talk about these more?
No.
So what do you mean by negligible variation interaction?
Negligible variation interaction, I am going to talk about more. On the next slide, I'm not going to talk about the exceptions. I'm going to talk about what I mean by the assumption. Right. Okay, so here we go. Unitary evolution on density matrices, I think that needs very little explanation. Now I'm going to have the Hamiltonian here is going to split up into system and environment and an interaction. And you can calculate, without any further assumptions, just straight from that, that if you have, say, the change in energy of one of the subsystems over some evolution, and you define this as being the work being performed through the time variation of the Hamiltonian of that subsystem, and this is a sort of standard term for work, then you also have a delta Q, which is a heat, which is almost like an energy flow into the system through the interaction term. Negligible variant interaction energy means, quite straightforwardly, that this term here is not varying very much in time, and that the total energy taken up by the interaction between the two is itself going to stay roughly constant. Obviously, this cannot vary in time, but if rho changes, as rho is changing, this has to be an additional assumption. Now, if you make those two assumptions, you get this, that the sum of all the energy flows between subsystems comes to zero. Statistical independence between initial systems is more or less straightforward, and we all know what the Gibbs canonical state is. And that's the exact technical assumptions you need, and that leads to a theorem. No Hamiltonian process is possible whose sole result is to return a system to its original marginal statistical state while transferring mean energies to initially uncorrelated canonical systems. And here beta has just been the dispersion parameter of the canonical distribution, unless this property holds. That is the mean energy times this dispersion parameter summed over all the initial canonical systems, which are going to be our heat baths, has to have a sum of greater or equal to zero. Now this is actually very, very like the generalized Clausius relationship in thermodynamics. And we can actually take this and we identify beta with 1 upon kt as saying that when it's a thermal system, which is one of our assumptions. And this immediately leads to the following statement. If there's a process whose sole result is to take the marginal state of a system from one state to another and depositing some energy in a heat bath, then there's no process that effectively takes it in the reverse from B back to A again, depositing mean energy in a heat bath, unless, well, the sum is going to be greater than or equal to zero, because that would be a cyclic process. And that's logically equivalent to the statement that there exists a single-valued function of statistical state rho. And the single-valued function has to have this property. Now, this hasn't uniquely defined such a function. There could be many, at this stage, functions that satisfy this. But the fact that such a function exists is a theorem. I'm not calling that anything. I happen to have suggestively labelled it S. But I'm not giving it a name. You can obviously go back from A to B. Well, you can go from B to A, and you get your delta BA. And we find that we have it wedged between these two values. If we have an optimal cycle, it's a cycle in which we go around the complete cycle and we do the best we can, which is zero, which means these two are going to add up to be zero for this case. And that's going to uniquely identify the change in this function, which is all very suggestive. And we can even state then, there's no process, now we've defined what this function is, there's no process taking a state from A to B on average depending energy QAB in a heat bath unless the function takes these values. Which is all very much like thermodynamic entropy, but it's not. I've made no assumptions about entropy, I've not mentioned entropy. Well, we can go a little further. We now go back and we look at our states in the limiting case of an isothermal evolution, and this means we go to a limiting case where we keep the system in contact with a variety of canonical thermal states, so it stays in a canonical thermal state itself at all times. We can actually calculate what the delta W on the state is, and we can then do some further calculations. We have HA, HB, and we actually get that the heat generated from A to B in this limiting case takes this form. Well, this means, and we can do this in either direction, and we have an optimal cycle. So we just take our function here, and we take the value we've got, and lo and behold, we can deduce that it has to be trace rho A log rho A, plus an additive constant, which is even more suggestive. Well, say something about the optimal paths. How am I doing for time?
We have 20 minutes until questions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, an optimal path, we've said, need an optimal path to define this trace rho log rho. It's not a property of a given unitary evolution. Given an initial and a final density matrix, it does turn out one can always, in principle, construct a unitary evolution that will be optimal between them. Given an initial density matrix and a unitary evolution, one can determine if that evolution is optimal. Now, what could mean it was not optimal? I'll get on to the next slide. But in general, a unit evolution that's optimal for one density matrix isn't optimal for a different one. So you can't really talk about the unitary evolution being optimal. You can talk about a process, which is the combination of the evolution and the state the evolution acts upon. So that process can be optimal, and that would be reversible. It's not necessary, though, for the either initial or final states to be thermal states, which is a bit of a deviation from what we're used to in phenomenological thermodynamics. So we can naturally now then define reversible being this kind of optimal path. An operation is reversible if and only if it can be incorporated into one of these optimal cycles. And that follows that if it can't be incorporated into an optical cycle, optimal cycle, even in principle, then it's irreversible. What would be the source of the irreversibility? Well, the closed cycle requires us to restore the marginal density matrix of all of the non-heat bath systems. That includes restoring accessible correlations between those systems. But microscopic correlations may become inaccessible. We also only have access to changing the Hamiltonians of the systems, and we can't change the Hamiltonian of the environment. So when we're trying to, we can't just reverse the unitary evolution for the whole universe. We can only do something with the actual systems we can get hold of. As a result, this inaccessibility, it seems to be that the irreversibility is just because we haven't got hold of these microscopic correlations. And it's been argued that this kind of argument is a problem because that means the irreversibility that we see around us is only apparent. Surely irreversibility should be more serious than that. It should be something that's out there in the physical world and not part of our perspective. But, it turns out that actually in a remarkably wonderful set of experiments, we can actually show that when the situations where these correlations appear to disappear and where we appear to get this irreversibility, well, if we, remarkably situations where we can turn things around and microcorrelations that appeared to be inaccessible come accessible again, and the apparent irreversibility can be restored. So maybe the irreversibility is just this apparent perspectival thing. I mean, at the moment, we actually have no evidence that it isn't. And some quite interesting evidence that says that in situations where we would think it is, where we would think it's real, it turns out it's not real. It's actually, it genuinely is just an apparent irreversibility. So just I want to avoid accusations that I've buried this, I want to state, here is the theorem, the important theorem. Given these four assumptions, then there's no process whose sole result is to change marginal statistical state of the system from rho A to rho B, depositing on average energy in heat baths, unless this holds. Now again, I still resisted calling anything entropy. Now it was really, really nice, we could call this entropy. I would like to call this entropy, obviously. But there's lots of people who object to calling this kind of thing entropy because they have certain notions of what entropy should be, and this doesn't fulfill their notion of what entropy should be. But it doesn't matter whether you call it entropy or not. You can call it entropy, you can call it anything else you like. The fact is, this theorem holds. It comes from these assumptions. And this theorem expresses a limitation on our ability to convert heat into work. And that's true whatever you choose to call this function. Now, one of the reasons people worry about this, however, is these rows. I've not said anything about these rows being anything to do with macroscopic or microscopic states. The density matrix can be over macroscopically distinct states. Some explanations of thermodynamic entropy are based upon microscopic notions like mixing or inaccessibility that aren't self-evidently applicable to macroscopic uncertainty. And by this I mean we have this shoe on the table. It's a funny-looking shoe, but we have this shoe on the table and there's some uncertainty as to whether it's here or here. That's what I mean by there being there's an indeterminism macroscopic in a macroscopic state. And now there's no sense in which that indeterminism is somehow to do with mixing of systems or inaccessibility of microscopic correlations. And one of the criticisms of this kind of thing is that, well, look, if this object here is either determinately in that state or it's indeterminately in that state, that's just a fact. It's out there, it's in the world. That the fact that we might be uncertain about it really shouldn't be entering into things. If we're going to talk about entropy, we want to have something that's an objective characterization of the state, and our uncertainty about where it is really shouldn't matter. There are also different possible sources of indeterminism that people worry about in these kind of cases, different notions of probability. But the fact is, it doesn't really matter. If you have this indeterminism as to where the object is, the theorem still represents a limitation on how much heat you can get from work. And you might have different values of what the mean value, the probability is. You might have different ideas of what the probability is. You might have different interpretations coming from that as to what the mean value of some property is. But as long as everybody assigns the same value to the probability, to each value, we're all going to get the same mean value, even if you disagree what that mean value signifies. So what does macroscopic indeterminateness give? Suppose we have this state, it's a row, and it has some S, which we may or may not call entropy, and by some indeterministic process, with some probability it ends up in this state row A, and with some probability it ends up in this state row B, and these probabilities are going to sum to 1. And in this indeterministic process, a certain amount of heat is generated. Now, the actual density matrix here is very clearly going to be this. If these states are orthogonal, we can calculate the S function value of the density matrix here, and it has this form. And from that, we can actually calculate from our theorem the minimum amount of heat that must have been generated. Why we get into trouble is because if we consider an optimal path from this state to this state, we can figure out how much heat must be generated by that optimal path. And if we consider the optimal path from our B state to our original state, we get a certain amount of heat generated by that. And if we form this funny thing, Q bar, in which we average these heats using the probabilities we got from our previous slide, then we get this value. And that has a relationship to our QM, and our relationship is actually that it has this extra term involved. And this means if we put this together and we have our indeterministic action, and then we apparently say, well, okay, if we find it in this state, then we put it back here. And if we find it in this state, then we put it back here. We can calculate that the total amount of heat generated has got to be greater than or equal to this value here. But here's a logarithm of a probability, so that's less than or equal to 0. So this is a total heat generated being greater than or equal to a negative number. And that means you can get work out. But we've started off with this here, and we've ended up back here, and we've got the total heat generated being greater than or equal to a negative number, and here's a problem, because that means we've got work. And this is the problem that people get worried about. Well, the thing is, our theorem told us that we got something wrong there, because our theorem tells us, actually, the best we can do, if we're going to end up back with here, we've done a closed cycle, and the best we can do is QD equals minus QM. So our theorem is telling us something, that if we're trying to get from here with a probabilistic mixture of these two, the best we can do is going to be different from the average of the two separate processes by this term. And I've said earlier, the optimum path is not a probability of a given unitary evolution. Given the initial and final density matrices, one can in principle construct an optimal unitary evolution between them, but in general, an evolution optimal for one initial density matrix is not optimal for a different initial density matrix. And the issue here is that the optimal attempt to get from our A state back to our zero state, and the optimal attempt to get from the B state back to the zero state, cannot be combined together. Because while it's optimal for the process that's optimal for the A state is most definitely not optimal for the B state, and vice versa. The optimal for the combination, well, the optimal for the combination is going to be a different process altogether. And that different process is going to actually only be able to extract a reduced amount of work. And that's a consequence of our theorem. So people still worry, if I see the new macrostate, hasn't the entropy gone down? The evolution of the system must still be unitary. So just because I see the system doesn't mean I can break the requirement for the world to be unitary. It just means I've got to include myself in the system. And I've got to define a unitary evolution upon myself and the system. And that unitary evolution has got to take into account what happens if I see the pen here and I see the pen there, and what I do in both cases, and the whole thing has still got to be described by unitary evolution, and it turns out I'm not going to do any better. And there's an analogy is that, well, here's a way of winning at roulette. If it comes up red, bet on red. Obviously, that doesn't work because you actually have to decide what your strategy is before they start the wheel spinning. And it's the same with unitary evolutions. The unitary evolution has to be a strategy that's going to take care of both options and still be unitary. Penrose actually in his 1970 book, this is Oliver Penrose, effectively goes from the Boltzmann to the Gibbs entropy by this kind of process. He starts by defining the entropies for the macroscopic states and notes that in the unitary evolution it separates into macroscopic states. The average entropies of the macroscopic states can go down, but the amount it goes down is by a term that's this P log P. Now you can then, in fact, he constructs effectively an erasure principle, and then you can, and then constructs a statistical entropy, which is given by the average of these Gibbs-Boltzmann entropies, plus this additional term. Okay, so how much longer have I got?
We have 10 minutes to questions.
10 minutes to questions, okay. Right. Well, the next lots of slides should go quickly. So we're now going to go into Looking Glass World and apply all this to the original problem of the Szilard-Landauer cycle. And Looking Glass World means we're going to actually start off where we ended up. We're going to start off in the situation of the daemon. And the daemon has some information in its memory. And it doesn't really matter what the information is of. It could have been, you know, what it had for dinner yesterday. And the daemon is also equipped with a box. And the daemon wants to get rid of its memory. And it's going to do it by this route, Dralet's erasure. Erasure is almost palindromic, unfortunately. And what it does is, if the daemon remembers one thing, left, then it puts the partition in the right-hand side. And if the daemon remembers the other thing, it puts the partition in the left-hand side. And then, if it was on the left-hand side, it compresses its box in whichever direction makes sense. This, we can calculate, it's an n-atom gas where n equals 1, so it requires amount of work equal to kT log 2. At the end of this compression, the daemon uses a correlating C0 type interaction to reset its own memory, and it can do this non-dissipatively. And then, at the end, the daemon simply pulls the partition out of the box. And hurrah, the daemon has managed to erase its memory at a cost of kT log 2. Seems a slightly complicated way of going about doing it, as we knew there was always a very easy way of doing it called Landauer erasure. But the daemon wanted to use this box. Now the daemon decides it wants to actually get some work out. And it's going to build an engine. And the way it builds this engine is it takes its memory and it expands its memory by moving one side. And it's going to call this an engine, or an enigma, because again, engine is very nearly palindromic. Riordan's enigma. So it pushes this, and this is an expansion of an n-atom gas where n is equal to 1. So it gets out kT log 2 work. Heat generated is greater than or equal to a negative number. And then, it simply removes the partition from the end. And if it wants to, it can slide the partition back in. Now, here's the funny thing. This route from here on this bottom left side to the top right, that was what the Szilard engine was supposed to do. And that was what the Szilard engine was supposed to do by this very complicated path of sticking partitions in boxes and doing correlating measurements and then doing correlating expansions and then removing things. It turned out the daemon could have just expanded its own memory. It could have thrown away the box and said, this box is a distraction. I can get the work out just by expanding my own memory. What conclusions can we... And these are exactly equivalent processes. So how do we understand this? What lesson can we learn from this? Well, what we're doing is we're doing cyclic paths. So we're starting off, and we're doing Szilard's engine, and we're getting to this other side. And this was our... And in the process, we got some work out. Well, that was great. And then, to get back again, we do this Landauer erasure, and it requires a certain amount of work to be done. That's good. The total work could be equal to 0. Or we can also say that the entropy difference between these two sides, and I'm now going to call S entropy just for the sake of argument, the entropy difference between these two sides is K log 2. And we can identify that from our theorem. Well, we could have done it differently. We could have done our Szilard engine, extracted the work from this, and then we could have just reversed the Szilard engine. And we've seen this would also required as kT log 2. And also would have set that the entropy difference between these two sides is K log 2. Land air erasure clearly wasn't actually required for us to understand that the Szilard engine didn't work. We could have just reversed the Szilard engine. It would have still been a perfectly valid cyclic path. Dralitz-Erujia would also do it. Simply reversing the path to complete the cycle should always have been sufficient. This mistaken belief that measurement was dissipative seems to have been one of the reasons why this got confused. And instead, large amounts of literature was written worrying about measurement and information and correlation and fluctuations. Also, however, the failure is actually known in advance because we haven't violated any of our assumptions, so we knew full well that that cycle couldn't have done better. If that cycle had done better, then we should be looking at those four assumptions and saying, well, one of those must have, at least one of those must have been violated. All the cycle actually does is establish that the entropy difference between the two sides is K log 2, which is a valuable thing to establish, but that's all it does. Now, we could have done another path. We have the cyclic Szilard's engine, and we saw we've also got the reverse Landauer engine. I made this up, but I still don't actually know how I should pronounce this. Roy-Adnal. Yeah. That's going to get us out KT log 2 of work. And we actually know where that work comes from. We know it's because these two sides differ in entropy by K log 2. The extraction of the energy from the Szilard engine, well, we were worrying about these fluctuations and putting partitions in boxes and information and measurements and other kinds of interactions and what was going on. But, you know, we actually could have got exactly the same path by using this reverse Landauer, the Roy-Adnal path. And that's clearly what we did, was we expanded the daemon's memory state. So very clearly the source of the actual energy is simply because the daemon state had been increased in entropy. There was no need to actually worry about fluctuations and measurement and so forth. And the Szilard box is really just a very complicated way of doing something that you can do very simply. And to return to the question of, well, the daemon ended up in this state where it was on one side or the other. We started off with our shoe in one position. Then it ends up in macroscopically one of two different positions. So we've got an increase in the entropy of the probability distribution for the shoe, and that's been the source of the work extracted. So the answer to Albert, who cares where the shoe ends up, is, well, actually, the only reason you got work out is because the shoe ended up in one of two different positions, and it had to be in one of two different positions. And you only got KT log 2 work out, which is actually a tremendously small amount of work. You could keep doing this, but you'd have to get more and more distinct positions the shoe could be in. And given that K is 10 to the minus 30-something, to actually get an appreciable amount of work, you'd need an enormously amount of distinctly different positions for a shoe. So you could get energy from isothermically expanding a shoe, but you'd have to be storing it in an enormously big warehouse. A warehouse large enough to hold all these different possible configurations of the shoe, and the warehouse would have to contain only one shoe. So that's the reason why you should care about where the shoe is. Well, there are further cyclic paths we can look at. So we had Landauer's erasure. We also found a different way of doing it, a more complicated way of doing it, both of which required the same amount of work. So this seems to say, well, they're both valid means of performing erasure. One might seem more complicated, but so what? Both have the same cost, so it seems to kind of support there's an idea of Landauer's principle that you can't do better. But that's not good enough. It's not a principle. It's not something new you want to introduce. It's a theorem of statistical mechanics. But that's still not good enough, because that hasn't established that you can't do better. That's just still given you two examples of paths which have that cost. Any particular example of erasure is never going to establish that was the minimum cost. It just establishes you've got that cost. However, by our theorem, if you have the opposite path, then the theorem tells you that will establish what the minimum cost is. So actually, if you think about it, if you have Szilard engine or Roy-Adnal's engine, and that gives you minus KT log 2 heat dissipated, that establishes that Landauer erasure must be at least KT log 2 work. So rather than being Landauer's principle explaining why the Szilard engine doesn't work, it's actually the Szilard engine path provides the justification for Landauer's principle. Yeah. Or equivalently, just simply doing the reverse. Okay, and I'm very nearly finished. Okay. The combined cycle has a net cost of zero, so all processes involved are reversible. So quickly, here's a cyclic path that people often worry about. You go from A to B. B is a statistical mixture. You just inserted a partition, and you remove the partition. That's clearly an optimal path. So clearly, these states have got to have the same entropy. So the fact that you have this statistical mixture, it isn't one entropy or the other. This mixture has an entropy significance. Overall, what we've seen is we can just actually run this any way we like, in any direction we like. The interesting points are actually here, where we actually generate heat. So we can actually bracket off all the places where we don't generate heat and say, all these states and all these states, this is not really working, all the states on the left box and all the states on the right box are connected by reversible paths, so must all be at the same entropy. And the two boxes are connected by reversible paths that have a kT log 2 energy difference, so we establish that the entropy difference between them is k log 2. And conclusion, the focus should be on the particular, not be on particular paths or processes, which has been what's been the case. Excessive attention is then given to particular processes. And the resulting explanations we end up are actually explanations that try to get into the nuts and bolts of one particular thing and say that there's this principle or that principle. But actually, it's just the existence of optimal cycles that incorporate states within that optimal cycle. That's enough. The explanation should not be tied to the specifics of a particular optimal cycle. And indeed, presupposed ideas of what statistical mechanical entropy is, ought to be, or is for are not necessarily helpful. Indeed, instead, there's a statistical mechanical theorem that doesn't need to presuppose a notion of entropy, but can, if you wish, define a notion of entropy. Statistical mechanics does provide this theorem, and it produces the Gibbs von Neumann entropy measure. Probability distributions over macroscopic states does reduce the convertibility of heat into work. And that's a consequence of unitarity, regardless of what we understand by probability. Landau's principle is valid, but it has been badly formulated, I think. It's not a principle, it's a theorem. It requires heat generation, but it's not necessarily irreversible. And it can even be done thermodynamically reversibly. Information theory is really a distraction. Maxwell's demons don't exist. A general proof, as I promised. And that is, however, subject to four assumptions, which may all be questioned. But when questioning them, they're sufficient conditions, they're not necessary conditions. So that's the end.
Essentially, the answer comes down to, you know, you have to keep a Maxwell's demon on the same basis as any other system in your... And that's the thing that people... is obviously a cause of problem when people think it's being macroscopic or whatever. So from that perspective, I mean, wasn't it... there's a smaller Chomsky, I don't know how you pronounce it. I mean, wasn't he, in a sense, on the right track in just saying that the thing is you've got to think about the demon as a physical object?
Yes. But also he... Unfortunately, I think, caused an awful lot of grief because, as well as in his paper saying, he does this calculation by treating it as a physical object, but he then had this quote at the end, in which was something to the effect that this leaves open the question of what happens if it's an intelligent being. And it was in trying to answer that question that Szilard was led to propose the Szilard engine, and much confusion and wackiness ensued.
I think I'm the person who named it Landauer's principle. In fact, I'm pretty darn sure of that. And that got me some awfully good letters of recommendation from Rolf, probably better than anybody else has ever gotten. So I wouldn't have called it Landauer's theorem because he didn't actually prove anything. So what would you suggest calling?
Morodny's theorem.
No. I derived something called generalized Landau's principle. I'm entirely happy with calling it Landau's principle because that's what
it is. It's not a separate principle, it's statistical mechanics, that's your basic.
No, it's certainly not a separate principle. It is best understood that it is a theorem, it's a consequence. I didn't actually catch what you said at your very first sentence.
I named it Landauer's principle.
Yeah,
he
again.
You named it.
Oh, you named it Landau's principle. Okay.
Near the Charles Bennett.
And I got you good letters from Landau?
Sure.
But there's nothing wrong with the principle for things which can be derived, I mean, like Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Yeah.
I mean,
Sure, there's lots of situations. I think the problem is that, firstly, Landau didn't really derive it in his paper. And so, to some extent, a lot of the literature following it has treated it as a new principle. And it's even seen papers in which they do sort of take it as a principle and apply it.
An axiom,
and try and apply it in situations where it's far from obvious that the statistical mechanical assumptions do actually apply.
Can it be more of a principle in thermodynamics? So if you don't want statistical mechanical derivation of these things, but you just want to state some thermodynamic laws. And so, like I've heard it, I think it was a Ben Schumacher talk where he said the Landau statement meant to be sort of analogous to the Clausius statement or something of the second law. Does that match what you're saying?
I'm not certain that one can say, take a statement of Landau's principle and from that deduce, say, the generalized Clausius theorem. I've never seen it done. And in terms of phenomenological thermodynamics, I can't see it. I mean, the problem with Landau's principle in phenomenological thermodynamics is that it's actually referring to probability distributions over states in the way that the Landau's principle works. And that doesn't actually have any part in phenomenological thermodynamics. There's no role for that kind of indeterminism and probability distributions. It really is a something that's a property of statistical mechanics. If someone had actually asked about what were the thermodynamics of computing before statistical mechanics came along, it actually would have been a tricky question to answer. And it would not have been obvious what the answer was. I don't know if that answers your question, or if you want.
I guess it's an answer.
Why don't we thank Owen for his clarity?